May please the court. My name is Sean McGuire, and I'm here representing the appellant in this case, Malcolm Johnson. Through the briefing of this case, it appears actually we are down to having very little to argue about.
We like that.
That's always everybody likes that, generally speaking, right? So we are at the point now, it's taken a little while, but we're at the point now where I think everybody agrees that my client was not eligible for dangerous offender sentencing, was not eligible for career offender sentencing. And the question, as I see it, the only question before the court now is, what does this court do with that? I take the position that the state has essentially waived any further argument as to other possible resolutions for this other than a remand for withdrawal of the plea. And I do that for a specific reason. Factually, my client had two different attorneys. He had one attorney that was present when the state first filed their career offender notice. And because of the fact that this case didn't ever go to a post-conviction hearing, we didn't get into the discussion about what conversations had happened between that attorney and my client. But we didn't raise that as an issue because we knew that the sole issue was the second attorney failing to properly advise my client that he was not eligible for dangerous offender sentencing. We raised that claim. The state responded with only one defense, which was, well, I don't know about dangerous offender sentencing, but he was eligible for statutory maximum sentencing anyway under career offender sentencing. And so therefore, if his attorney said that you're eligible for statutory maximum sentencing, that was wise and prudent advice. That was the only defense that they put forward. Well, that was, as we now know, was incorrect. My client was, it's not explicit in the record, but is inferred from the record. He was given the proper advice on career offender sentencing by his original attorney. And that is that he was not eligible for that. State could have said, well, even if we're wrong about that, we have this other alternate argument. They could have joined in our request to have an evidentiary hearing, at least on an alternative basis, and they did none of that. Immediately after getting the state's post-conviction, I filed a reply basically saying, no, you're also wrong about career offender sentencing. And the judge's order issued the next day. I have no idea how the timing of that worked, but I know I filed my reply, I think the day or the day after I received the state's post-conviction response. So now we're here. We're here in a situation where we all agree that these provisions didn't apply. So I'm guessing the state would like to try to argue that maybe my client chose to plead guilty on some other basis, but
well, couldn't that basis arguably be that your client received a 97-month sentence plus the 3-month custody enhancement, and the top of the box presumptive sentence was 129 months?
Yes, I would agree that the state had other arguments available they could have made and said that was the reason.
But
they didn't make those arguments
okay.
At any point in time.
But clearly, I understand your argument to be that your client relied upon an erroneous belief that he would be subject to either the career offender statute or sentencing as a dangerous offender. But without an evidentiary hearing, how do we know why he did what he did?
I think the if you're viewing this in terms of a kind of a search for the truth, then I understand the court's point, right? Because we don't have for the records, and I asked for an evidentiary hearing, so in case those things came up. At some point in time, however, there's plenty of questions that get presented to courts that or could be presented to courts that where things where those issues get waived if you don't contest them, and from my perspective, there's plenty of time for the state to fashion such an argument. So it's really
You're arguing that because the state didn't say there's no evidence that he relied upon this erroneous information, that the state cannot now request an evidentiary hearing?
They asked for there to be no evidentiary hearing, right? So they asked for the court to rule on this alternative basis. Okay. And my point is essentially it's a judicial economy point, which is if you have a response, you need to put it forward. And so if there's a question, a factual issue in dispute, then, you know, and the court ruled, let's say in the scenario where the state put forth alternative arguments, the state could have said, well, there was this other basis under the career offender, so it was good advice. But even if there wasn't that basis, then we would say that we need to have an evidentiary hearing in that circumstance.
Well, let me ask you this. When your client filed his petition for post-conviction relief, did he include his own affidavit saying that I relied on, this is why I pleaded guilty, or did he submit an affidavit of either of his attorneys saying, we discussed this, and I know that I counseled him to plead guilty because of the statutory maximum he faced?
I don't believe so. We were, at that time, we were hoping for an evidentiary hearing at the time. So as I said, the idea of an evidentiary hearing at that time, I would have said, yes, that's totally appropriate. If that's a question, it's just about whether the state can now come up with an alternative. It's a judicial economy argument. That's all it is.
Counsel, the question I have is, am I understanding your request for plea withdrawal to be in the alternative? One, the plea should be withdrawn because it's invalid, because it's involuntary, because it was based on an improper threat of coercion. Or in the alternative, there was ineffective assistance of counsel because he wasn't properly counseled about his circumstances, and he relied on improper advice, and but for that advice, he wouldn't have pleaded guilty.
The arguments are in the alternative.
Do you even need reliance as to the first argument? I mean, an appellate court determines de novo whether or not a plea is valid. It can be raised for the first time on appeal, and I'm just questioning whether there needs to be a showing of reliance if the argument is my plea was invalid. It seems to me that under the case law, you just have to show your plea is invalid and it's automatic plea withdrawal. And you only get to reliance if you're going to the ineffective assistance of counsel, because that's the two prong. Was it objectively unreasonable, and would the outcome have been different, which is would he have taken the deal nonetheless?
I agree that that's a closer call. I haven't seen a whole lot of arguments. I'm just being frank here. I haven't seen a lot of arguments that have where they're, because the argument is essentially the state put forth inherently coercive things by filing these notices for upper departure that were without a proper foundation, right? And I haven't seen cases one way or other saying that is by itself sufficient. I would say that the issue if you are, if I think there needs to be some responsibility by the state to investigate whether before you file a notice for an upward departure, whether that's even appropriate. So I think that I do think that that's inherently coercive. Whether there needs to be some additional factual connection between that that choice by the state and the decision to plead guilty, I have not seen a case that is just like this.
Mr. McGuire, since if I understand correctly, the request for the evidentiary hearing was already after your knowledge that neither of the statutory aggravating sentencing factors would have applied. What were you anticipating would be the evidence on behalf of your client you would have presented at that evidentiary hearing?
Because I had put forth kind of these alternative theories, one focused on the state's actions, one focused on my client's attorney's actions, I try to cover all of my bases in case it becomes a relevant factual question about whether or not, let's say, for example, the attorney's misadvice was the thing that caused him to plead guilty. I think there could be a factual dispute that would be relevant, I generally request an evidentiary hearing. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
That's it in a nutshell. I don't have, we're not disputing a lot of the other stuff that I started out on this journey with anymore. Because this starts, and all throughout the process, the state had ample ability to look and see whether these things applied and either decide not to file the aggravating notices, or even in the post-conviction process to say, we were wrong about that. Let's have an evidentiary hearing. They chose not to do any of that. We're asking that this be remanded for my client to withdraw his plea. That's it.
Thank you. I will give you a chance for rebuttal.
Okay.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Your Honors, John Holitz on behalf of the state of Minnesota, St. Louis County Attorney's Office. I largely agree with Mr. McGuire and appellant. The sole issue for the court is really what to do with the errors that I concede that I made. My position, of course, is that we need to remand for exactly what petitioner was asking for at the district court level, that being an evidentiary hearing. We need to establish that record about exactly why he did take the plea that he took. First of all, I would, I think I have in my brief, concede that my error and miscalculation regarding the aggravated sentencing notices, they're my errors. I made them. There's no dispute to that. I made that in preparation, and I made that error again at the post-conviction level, and the post-conviction court did rely on that in issuing its order. So I need to concede those things. I did not do that for an intentional or a coercive reason. It just was a miscalculation given the convoluted nature of the defendant's criminal history or the appellant's criminal history. But it's my position that does not equal or that does not equate to the automatic withdrawal of a plea due to this or pursuant to a manifest injustice standard. The right and proper remedy is to go back to the district court level for an evidentiary hearing.
Mr. Holitz, I'm the same question. I'm just curious, especially given the case law, the Supreme Court, the Brown versus State, and and Deacon case all reference that and the unpublished opinion in Knutson, that it's undisputed that that aggravating factor had not been withdrawn. In fact, the trial court, which I assume the trial judge, everyone presumed was still a valid potential. Is not that really all there is in the record that would the defendant would satisfy, therefore, that the plea should be withdrawn because of that existence? In other words, what more would be presented to show it's involuntary under that case law?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you brought up the Knutson unpublished decision, because I do think it's instructive on this on that point, on your question. I don't think that the Knutson, that unpublished decision that's cited by appellant, I don't think that that says, based on the miscalculation on an aggravated sentencing motion, I don't think that case says withdrawal. Certainly that's a different situation where you have this state's lack of candor in a package deal. And the court, this court actually, in that opinion, they talk about, it's really a disingenuous move by the state to make this package deal with the defendant there for the dismissal of the charges against his significant other, and then turn around 2 weeks later and charge the significant other with additional crimes from a different date that are of the same significance. And in fact, this court said, even without this element, and again, I'm talking about the error in the calculation of the aggravated sentencing motion, even without that element, appellant is entitled to withdraw his plea. So I take Knutson, and my reading of Knutson is that Knutson stands for the fact that this switcheroo business that the state pulled, that, of course, entitles someone to withdrawal a plea, but it does not stand for the fact that the error in miscalculation of the aggravated sentencing automatically entitles somebody to a withdrawal of plea. It certainly is something that needs to be considered, and I think it's proper to be considered by the trial court.
So just to clarify, if the at the evidentiary hearing, defendant chooses to testify, and the question is, why did you accept this plea? And he said, well, because I had this aggravating, and then they were agreeing on the bottom of the box, would that end it at that point?
I think at the evidentiary hearing, the state could certainly present additional evidence about the goings-on before the negotiations and the other factors that could lead a person, and that do lead people to take pleas. There certainly are more decisions than just the top end of a presumptive sentence that people take when into account when they make a decision to enter a guilty plea.
But counsel, the problem I'm having with this argument that in order to show that his plea is invalid, he has to show that but for the improper coercion, threat, or inaccurate information, he wouldn't have pleaded guilty. I mean, generally speaking, for plea withdrawal cases, we just look to see whether or not the plea was unintelligent or involuntary. I'm not aware that we go one step further and say, okay, did the circumstance which caused the plea to be involuntary, unintelligent, actually prompt him to plead guilty? We just, you know, whether a plea is intelligent, we ask, did the defendant understand what he was charged with and the consequences of a plea? And then you generally look to what would the sentence be. And here there's an argument that, well, he was told the sentence would be one thing. That was incorrect. Does that make the plea involuntary or unintelligent? I don't know. But what I'm not understanding is why we would then have to ask, oh, and is that the reason he pleaded guilty? It seems to me this sort of reliance on misinformation or threat only comes into play when we're assessing the plea in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. Because there we do ask, you know, but for counsel's failure to properly advise, you know, would this guy have actually pleaded guilty? But I don't know if we ask that question when we're assessing the validity of a plea.
And I guess I don't particularly have a response to that, other than to say that I don't think we have a record sufficient right now for the court to say that. Without having the evidentiary hearing that that he requested.
So what I hear you saying then is, we need an evidentiary hearing so we can determine whether or not his plea was involuntary in the first place, or whether it was unintelligent. You're not conceding those points.
I'm not conceding those points because we haven't had the evidentiary hearing. And what we have is a transcript of his plea that would indicate that it was. And then we have my error. And so I think the hearing and the district court would be in the best position to really weigh in on that evidence and create a record for an appeal, should there need to be an appeal. Other than what I've already said, I'm here to concede my error and concede that my error misled the district court. And so to the extent that an evidentiary hearing is necessary or should be held, I support that and would ask the court to send us back to the district court for just that.
It appears we don't have any additional questions, but I just want to thank you for being forthright and conceding your error. It is a confusing statute.
It is. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Can you still hear me?
We can hear you, and in a little while, we'll probably be able to see you again.
Oh. that may not be great.
We can see you again.
All right. I have just a few quick seconds for rebuttal. Again, I also appreciate the fact that Mr. Holitz has come before the court and basically said we made some mistakes, and that's I do appreciate that. Judge Larkin asks, and I want to clarify kind of my response to your inquiry. When I said there's not any cases that are directly like this, there's some hints in that Brown-Knutson area. I mean, Knutson's not published, so I try to avoid hanging my hat on those. But there's a passage here the question is, he says, a guilty plea may not be based upon or on any improper pressures or inducements. So when I parse that out, one question is, are these improper pressures or inducements? I think this court can just look at this and say, absolutely. There's really not any dispute about that. To be clear, I am not trying to portray any argument that there's some malice behind that or anything like that. I don't think that's required, because the question is about whether the plea is valid, not whether the state acted in bad faith. The question, I guess, is do you have to connect that improper inducement to the decision, right? And I think when you have when you get into a post-conviction evidentiary hearing, the state, the defendant, can put forth lots of, theoretical responses. District court judges can make inferences from how they perceive the testimony, and there's a lot of discretion given in that area. And I think this really is an area where there really should just be a bright line rule, where all of this is completely within the power of the state. The state has total control whether to file this notice. They've got all the time in the world to double check the statute, to double check the convictions, to see if they're correct. And a situation like that, it is a huge, by the way, statutory maximum sentencing, the specter of that kind of sentencing is a big deal. And so I don't know that this court needs to inquire very far into that question or leave that open. I would suggest, with regards to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that would have for sure been a basis to have an evidentiary hearing. I do also think that the kind of the course the litigation took at the choosing of Mr. Holitz, I think, suggests that why are we going down this path now? But I do think when you have a real kind of a bright line, I don't want to use the word threat because that implies some kind of intent behind it, but to a client, that's what it feels like. I think that it's hard to, it'll be almost impossible to, unless my client would come before the court and say, this had nothing to do with why I pleaded guilty, then I think a remand for consideration of that would be kind of just an invitation to fill in the blanks on the reasons based upon everybody's perceptions, and it gets further and further removed from kind of the objective facts of the case, which are simply that the motions were not appropriate and had a inherently coercive effect. And that's it.
All right, thank you very much. Arguments by both counsel were very good. We appreciate that, and the matter is taken under advisement.